Hello and welcome to a special Spectator podcast sponsored by the wealth management firm Charles Stanley. So, has the government found a magic money tree? It might seem that way when the furlough scheme and various other COVID bailout measures have taken government debt to more than £2 trillion. But the markets don't seem able to work out whether this is the time to be bold or to be cautious. The stock market has improved incredibly since its post-lockdown low. So what should investors do? Where are we economically? Is this really the time to get back into the market, or the time to get out while the going is still relatively good? And what does this new economic and financial environment mean for investors, savers, and the less well-off? I'm Fraser Nelson, and to discuss this question, I'm joined by David Miles, who's an economist at Imperial College London, also formerly a member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee. I'm joined by Harriet Baldwin, a Conservative MP, currently on the Treasury Select Committee, and by Paul Aberley, who's Chief Executive of Charles Stanley. So, Paul, let's start with you. Isn't this the sort of the time where investors should just be keeping their money under the mattress and not really investing it? Because let's face it, there is no way of telling whether the stock market is about to collapse once again.
Well, I would say no, because I think the social contract remains in place. And this goes back to the financial crisis where the authorities reduced interest rates on cash and bonds to zero, encouraging people to buy equities, which of course would stimulate the economy and improve those equity returns. But the other side of the social contract was it was understood that if we got volatility in equity markets, the authorities would make it known that they were ready to do more monetary policy easing, and that would support the markets. And that's worked really well. And indeed, if you look at where equity markets are today, they're a damn sight higher than one would have imagined a year ago if you'd painted this scenario. And I think that deal is still in place for now.
Right. David, what has been the effect of the Bank of England's interventions? We've had a couple of £100 billion of quantitative easing. Is it the case that this will, this time as last time, feed through to equities and therefore be a pretty good time to invest? Because there might be uncertainty, but for as long as banks are printing money, this is going to inflate assets and therefore investors ought to avail themselves of stocks.
Well, the bank's bought a huge amount more of gilts and is on track to own something like £750 billion of gilts within a few months. So the scale of this is enormous. But actually, the impact on gilt yields, on interest rates on government debt, has been rather muted. Now, that doesn't mean it's irrelevant, because obviously what's happened at the same time is that the government has issued a vastly greater amount of debt than anyone thought, because they're running a huge fiscal deficit. So it's possible that without the Bank of England having bought a load of gilts, then yields might have gone up. So I suppose one could say that the Bank of England's purchases have probably stopped gilt yields going up rather than driven them down to any large extent.
Right. But David, this is rather an important point, isn't it? Because the Bank of England isn't going to keep printing money forever. Now, whether you're an investor or whether you're somebody just interested in the stability of the economy, you're asking yourself, what is going to happen? Because right now, almost every pound that the government has borrowed has been bought up by the Bank of England down the road. When this ends, when the magic money tree stops being shaken in November, aren't we then going to see who's been swimming naked when the tide goes out? Are we then going to see interest rates going back up to the 1%, 1.5%, which could have devastating consequences for a government borrowing so much money?
I think that will depend on a couple of things. It's not obvious that that will happen. It might happen, and we'll see, but I don't think it's obvious. The first thing I think that really matters is what's the outlook for inflation? And at the moment, it's pretty subdued. And my guess is that one thing that will happen between now and the end of the year, when the Bank of England is on track to stop buying more gilts, is that unemployment will go up by a shockingly large amount. And I suspect that the outlook for inflation will be that it'll be very low for as far ahead as you care to look. And I think that will prevent interest rates on government bonds rising particularly sharply. I think there's another point which I think is really relevant when you stand back a bit and think about what QE may or may not have done since it was launched, well, in 2009, And it's this, that if you take the clearest possible measure of the overall real interest rate in the UK, the interest rate in real terms that the government has to pay on its debt, that's the yield on index-linked bonds. And that's been on a downward trajectory for about 35 years. When the UK gilt market, index-linked gilt market, started up in the early 1980s, when the UK government issued inflation-proof bonds for the first time, they were paying about plus 4% interest rate. That's real, inflation adjusted. That then gradually declined, so that just before the financial crisis, 2005 or so, that yield was down to plus 1. It had gone from plus 4 to plus 1. It continued on a downward trajectory, reached 0 a few years ago, and is now about minus 2 and a bit. But if you showed a picture of that trajectory of the real interest rate to somebody who did not know when the Bank of England was buying lots of gilts, they would not be able to infer from that picture, because it is such a smoothish downward trajectory that's lasted 3.5 decades. So I think there is a tendency for people to actually overestimate the significance of quantitative easing in affecting real interest rates.
So, Harriet Baldwin, we're entering a period now where people can basically forget about getting any real interest on their savings. I mean, Paul is talking about a long-term 30-year trajectory where interest rates would basically hit zero and then keep going and be basically minus two in real terms. So are we into a kind of financial, through the financial looking glass now, where people are being effectively paid to borrow? The government is borrowing at negative real interest rates, and we're getting an explosion of debt, which risks, does it not, setting some pretty unstable precedents? Because last time countries borrowed lots of money, the bubble burst in 2008. I'm wondering if there's a risk of the bubble bursting this time as well.
Well, there's been the long-term challenge in the UK economy of productivity and productivity growth. And I think what will be the end result of all this borrowing is a function of how productively it is put to use during this period. And the worry is, I think, that if it is simply unproductively used or used to do things that are, as in Japan in the 1990s, a bridge to nowhere, for example, then it's not going to unlock the potential of the British economy. I think what we're seeing in terms of the decision by the government is to try and invest in infrastructure that makes the country much more productive, but also in terms of qualifications and training to help people take advantage of the changes that will inevitably happen in the economy. And so that productivity challenge is the one which will lead us to know whether or not we're going to get good returns on our money in the long term.
So, Paul, the government's argument right now is that, yes, it's borrowing a lot, but it's borrowing to build bridges, to build roads, to improve the infrastructure, to make the economy going again. And also, I guess markets are looking at the global trajectory of the coronavirus, and they're being a lot more optimistic than we would have thought. A lot of markets have completely recovered now. I think in London, where the FTSE 100 is still down, but in other countries, they're almost completely there. So do you think the markets are looking at this and thinking, effectively, panic over, we're going to get back to normal a lot quicker than we thought?
I think yes, but in the short term. I think the infrastructure, you know, may be over-egged in terms of the percentage of the money that's accounted for by bricks and mortar. The majority of it is obviously preserving spending power. I think that will be effective in the near term. I think for investors that have a long-term time horizon, the real issue is the denouement from all of this. In theory, you know, if you take conventional economics, we've gone from conventional monetary policy to unconventional monetary policy after the financial crisis. We're now in phase three, which is hallucinogenic monetary policy. There's no way this should work. It ought to cause Weimar-type hyperinflation. Unless you subscribe to modern monetary theory, which says that the old approach was actually fundamentally misunderstood. And we can just print money. It's our own currency. The Treasury can borrow, the Bank of England can print, and we just cancel it all at some point in time. So in that sense, it doesn't really matter. But that's a massive leap of faith, because if modern monetary theory is incorrect, then at some point there's a reckoning for all of this debt that's been created.
And dare I ask what your instinct is, Paul? I mean, do you think that this modern monetary theory is actually a modern magic money tree?
Embarrassingly, I do. I say embarrassingly because I was a former bond vigilante in the days when President Clinton obsessed about the bond market.
Yes, and James Carville used to say that if he could be reincarnated, he'd come back as the bond market because it terrified everybody. Now the bond market terrifies nobody.
Absolutely. We've handed in our guns, traded in our horses, and it doesn't work that way anymore. And I think the modern monetary theory, I think, is probably correct. And I think it's very different for the private sector because private debt contracts, I think, are a real concern because they've got to be paid back and there will be a lot of economic disruption. But as far as the public sector is concerned, I have to say, I think as long as there is spare capacity, which there is as far as the eye can see, I don't think all this money printing will turn into inflation.
Right. Well, the thing is, David, you'll remember after the crash, when quantitative easing was first announced in such measures, a lot of people, I must admit I was one of them, said, look, this will absolutely lead to inflation. It can't not. Inflation is dictated by the supply of money. And if you print all of this money, it might take a year, it might take two, but there will be a massive inflationary spike. Do you think it's fair to say now that that theory has been disproven and that those who do think that inflation follows QE are simply adherents of an old ideology and that new modern monetary theory is the new game in town?
I think modern monetary theory is incoherent gibberish. However, I also think that the idea that because quantitative easing arithmetically almost causes some measures of the money supply to rise, that is necessarily inflationary. I mean, the way quantitative easing works is the Bank of England buys a load of gilts and that increases the asset side of its balance sheet. The liability side of its balance sheet rises because commercial banks' deposits at the Bank of England go up. What happened after the financial crisis is that commercial banks wanted their deposits at the Bank of England to go up, and they were happy for them to sit there. And that's partly because they were too worried about borrowing from each other to think that the interbank market would work. So they wanted to hold lots more deposits at the Bank of England. So the money supply did indeed go up, but it was willingly held and not at all inflationary. And modern monetary theory, by the way, the reason I think it's gibberish and its understanding of quantitative easing is close to zero is that it thinks that quantitative easing, as, for example, practiced by the Bank of England, they think that that is the equivalent to simply printing money, and it's not, in the sense that it's the liability of the Bank of England that is created to finance the quantitative easing, and that is interest-bearing. The Bank of England bank rate means the interest rate that is paid on the liabilities of the Bank of England held in the form of bank reserves. So the idea that you could cancel the debt that the central bank has bought would leave the central bank bankrupt as soon as interest rates go up. And if you have a central bank that's committed to try and control inflation, it will at some point put interest rates up, and it would then be bankrupt if it cancelled all the gilts, because it would be paying interest on the liabilities and it would have no asset on the other side. Modern monetary theory seems not to understand this.
Harriet Baldwin, how relaxed are you about all of the extra quantitative easing? I mean, last time it didn't have the inflationary effect, but it did inflate assets, it did inflate stocks. And if you look at who, basically, if assets go up, then the richest get most of that because they're the ones with the most assets, surprise, surprise. So it raises certain equality issues. I wonder if we're about to repeat this story of inequality with those who are lucky enough to be able to invest in shares, in property, in vintage Ferraris, or all of these other things shares went up, where they're about to get rich again with people at the bottom left behind.
Well, I think this is one of the major worries. And I do think, to start, though, that quantitative easing at this moment in time is absolutely the right thing to do. And I think also, very importantly, unlocking the cyclical buffer, the way that the Bank of England has allowed £190 billion of extra lending to come into the system as a counter-cyclical measure is really important. But again, it's important that that gets invested productively to have the right long-term impact. But you're absolutely right that the disadvantage of quantitative easing for my constituents will be that it makes things more expensive. So things being very important things to my constituents, like houses, like pension assets. You know, this is a real a policy problem if it is allowed to get very far ahead of itself. And you're seeing with the record price for gold at the moment, you know, that is telling you that because all the central banks around the world are doing this, that everyone is chasing the price of these real assets. So I think we do have to keep, as politicians, a very, very close eye on that, because it could have the potential to feed into even more unaffordable house prices for my constituents who are not on the housing ladder.
Now, Paul, what should we make about the rise of gold? We've seen it surge recently. We've seen silver go up about 30% last month. When these precious metals tend to go up in value, it's normally the sign of trouble to come, isn't it?
It is. I struggle personally with investing in stuff like gold. I mean, at a time when you can fly helicopters on Mars, you think, why would you pay a fortune for a lump of useless metal? But of course, it's got that. People have that trust that it somehow has some intrinsic value, you know, for historical reasons. I think what it's telling you is that there are a lot of people who are understandably very worried that when governments can just print money without any bird coming home to roost, that they'll become drugged on that and carry on until the coinage is debased, to use that old phrase. So I think it's quite logical for people to have that fear. I think perhaps longer term, a better way to hedge that risk would be to invest in equities that have some sort of real asset sitting behind them. But that's
Like what, for example?
And that's the problem. That's easier said than done. So you would say things like, well, property that carries a rent. And yet, of course, commercial property is a very hazardous place.
Right now, we're sitting here in London, where it's about 20% of its normal busyness. Commercial property in this city is not going to be that valuable an asset.
No, it's going to be toxic. You could think of companies that have assets in the ground. But of course, they're risky as well, because if the green agenda regathers pace post the crisis, then having oil, coal, whatever in the ground on your balance sheet might also be a problem. So the simple answer is to look for real assets, but it's easier said than done right now because of other reasons.
Right. And David, what do you think of the medium-term prospects for the economy? And some argue that we're about to hit a second wave, not of coronavirus, but of unemployment. And when the unemployment starts to rise, you're going to start to get consumer spending hit. And that's when we can expect the real economic pain. That so far, we've all been through this relatively, Paul might say hallucinogenic, but we're in a strange time where we have been through the virus, but the government bailouts have really stopped the pain hitting the labour market. If the unemployment is about to hit us, then might the economic outlook start to look more like a double dip than a Nike swoosh recovery?
Yes, I think that's a very real fear. As you rightly say, the government so far has cushioned the impact on unemployment. The unemployment rate, remarkably, has hardly edged up in the UK, unlike in the US. I think, unfortunately, we've got that rather ahead of us. And it will happen fairly soon, I suspect. And between now and Christmas, it's entirely plausible that unemployment will increase by many hundreds of thousands, if not by millions. And so I'm very much more pessimistic than those who say, oh, well, look, we're on track for a V-shaped recovery. Although output fell a lot in the second quarter, in June it was up a lot, we're bouncing back. I think that's far, far too optimistic. And I suspect, unfortunately, that we will be living with the after effects of the virus and government policies toward the virus. We'll be living with the after effects for a very long time.
So David, did you think we could be facing a double dip? Or are you just saying that the recovery might take 2 or 3 years to get back to where we were in January?
Yes, I think the more likely outcome is that it's just a very slow progression back to where the output might have been at the end of last year. Of course, that would be pretty awful if that took 3 or 4 years, when you might have expected GDP to grow by 2-2.5% a year, and 4 years down the road you're only at the same level as you were at the back end of 2019. You've still lost 7 or 8% of GDP. So that's pretty ghastly. I fear also, I'm at risk of sounding like a real grumpy here, but I also fear that as well as what you might call the short-term impact over 2-3 years, There's a longer term impact, which I think we all understand. And it's partly educational, it's partly medical. It's all those people that didn't get treated for, didn't get screens for cancer, and didn't have heart problems looked at, and diabetes, all the other things that are on hold, which I think will affect people's health for many years to come. And then, as you understand, you know, very well, Fraser, there's the longer term impact on terrible disruption to young people's education, which has now lasted 6 months and may last longer. Who knows quite what kind of education schools and universities will be offering people come September. And all the evidence is that the long run impacts of that, for many years, if not decades, are potentially very serious. I think this has been an economic catastrophe.
Now, Harriet Baldwin, historically, when countries have recovered from war, when they've recovered from pandemic, they have recovered very quickly. And this is why you get so many people talking about a V-shaped recovery. And the chief economist of the Bank of England says the recovery is so far so V. That's his language. What are your gut feelings about this? And did you think that the economy will have more healing power than people think? Or are you struck by just how long it's taking us to get out of lockdown?
Well, I think the crucial thing is going to be reopening the sectors of the economy that are still shut. And we're recording this on the 14th of August. I was really pleased to hear we have opened some large swathes of the economy today. And I think that's what I would like to see policymakers focus on, because if we can get all of those sectors of the economy, particularly the self-employed who have taken a huge, huge hit here, doing the things that they do best, you know, putting on productions, making films, the creative sectors, the hospitality sectors, the tourism sectors, these are really big parts of the UK economy. And so I think the focus needs to be how we reopen all of those safely using some of these very innovative new testing machines that are coming out, the kinds of things. Let's get the private sector to solve those problems. People coming back into the UK, having visitors from overseas who will spend money here. You know, those are the kinds of things that we need to see for us to get all the way back on the V. I accept that the V, we're back to sort of probably 90-95% by opening the sector so far, but there's those remaining sectors, and some of the most creative people in this country who are self-employed are the ones that are struggling to earn a living at the moment.
So, Paul, does this fundamentally come down to optimism or pessimism then? And if you're optimistic about our chances of recovering from this, then now would be a pretty good time to invest while there's so much uncertainty. I mean, if you look at, I saw a piece of Charles Stanley research actually a while ago, just pointing out just how often the biggest single gaining days in the stock market have been after disasters. So if you sit out that period, you miss as an investor, you risk missing out on some of the biggest gains. Is now the time to be bold or the time to be cautious?
I think it's the time to be bold, but I think the smart way to do that is to look at how things will change going forward, because even if the economy does recover in the way that more optimistic forecasts are saying, the shape of that will be different. So, you know, globalization, everyone now accepts that globalization is fantastic when things go well, but if things go wrong, globalization becomes extremely uncomfortable. So looking again at supply chains, looking again at the deal between China and the West for the last 30 years, clearly that's unravelling at speed. Mm-hmm. That's just two examples. Put all those factors together, and I think whatever happens in terms of the level of economic growth, the constituencies and the shape of the economic growth that will move ahead will create some pitfalls for investors, but will also create some opportunities, so that the challenge is being clever enough to work out how you can profit from the changing shape of that economic recovery rather than simply betting on the size of it.
Of course, Harriet, this isn't the end of the story. I mean, the idea is that eventually this quantitative easing will unwind. I've never quite worked out how that works and what the investment effect will be.
And that's because it's never been done. And when Ben Bernanke suggested that he was going to do it, I think it was back in 2014, the markets fell apart. And I do think that's a very, very genuine question that investors would need to ask themselves at the moment, because if we have a spike in inflation, if central banks do have to start to unwind some of the easing they've put into the market, I think markets will find that very hard to cope with.
And David, isn't it the funny position here that the government wholly owns the Bank of England, so the government effectively owes money to itself? Couldn't it just cancel that debt and forget about unwinding?
No, it can't. And the reason it can't cancel the debt is that The way the Bank of England's financed the purchase of the gilts is by issuing its own debt in the form of reserves held by private financial institutions, and they pay interest. So you cannot just cancel the gilts that the Bank of England holds, because then the Bank of England would be bankrupt and then the government would have to bail it out, and it's a waste of time cancelling it. What QE does is simply, I say simply, I mean, it allows the government not to print money and never pay interest on debt. That's not what it does. It allows the government to finance itself at very short-term interest rates, namely Bank of England's bank rate. That happens to be very low at the moment, although no lower than gilt yields. Bank of England bank rate's 0.1 of 1%. 10-year gilt yields are about 0.1 of 1%. This is why modern monetary theory is so profoundly mistaken. You can't just cancel the stuff. It would be a waste of time. The government would seem to gain, but it would have to recapitalise the Bank of England, and it wouldn't have got anywhere.
Right. And Paul, do you think that the unwinding of QE will be a moment of danger for investors? I mean, we are entering uncharted territory the whole time, and unwinding QE is something which, as Harriet was saying, hasn't really been done before. So if you are intending to invest now, if you need to get ahead of the QE lift, are you looking at a potential IED waiting for you on the investment horizon?
I think that's absolutely right, and for that reason, I don't think they will unwind QE. I think if you look back really to the 1970s, when the dollar broke its link with gold and world of fiat currency really came in, you could argue since then we've had credit cycles, not economic cycles, and the build-up to the financial crisis was the private sector leveraging up like crazy. It passed the baton to the public sector when that bubble burst, and since then the public sector has been inflating balance sheets, building up more and more debt. I don't see you can easily put that into reverse. So frankly, if modern monetary theory is wrong, then my goodness, there's a reckoning at some point, because I don't see how you can reverse that expansion of global debt without causing an economic depression.
And David, what's your theory? If it is gibberish, as you say, then are we facing a reckoning?
Well, that will depend on, I think, whether inflation takes off or not. I mean, if it does, then central banks, not just in the UK but across the world, will almost certainly have to raise interest rates, and maybe far more than markets are anticipating. And there's no doubt at all that if that were to happen, there's a lot of people who've borrowed a great deal in the expectation that interest rates will stay very low, and they're going to be burned. So I think there is a day of reckoning potentially coming, although I also think that the economic harm done by the virus is so great that it will actually depress inflation. And so that rather dreadful scenario for people who've borrowed a lot may not come about. But they shouldn't rejoice at that, because the reason it won't come about is that the damage to the economy is actually quite long-lasting and severe.
And Harry Baldwin, finally, if you do think that there might be a reckoning around the corner, and I suspect that Chancellor Rishi Sunak would certainly not discount that probability, then surely the thing to do now is to go easy on how much you borrow. It used to be said that the few things are inevitable: death, taxes and future financial crises. If we're going to get another one, shouldn't the government be borrowing a lot less than it is right now?
Well, when he announces his phase three plan, which will be sometime this autumn, I think he has got to set out the kind of measures, the plan, as it were, for us to get the deficit back under control. It doesn't have to necessarily be implemented at that time, but I think he's got to show that direction of travel in order to have the confidence of the markets. And the IMF chief economist told the Treasury Select Committee that now was not the right time to start raising taxes, but setting out a plan or coming up with the plan for how you might get things back into balance. This was the right time to do the planning.
And David, one final question. I know what you say about the debt interest graphs. I've seen them myself for 30 years. They've been falling. But does this suggest that there is basically nothing the government can do now to get a caustic reaction from the bond markets, that Boris Johnson can spend whatever he likes, he can borrow whatever he likes, he can throw as much money at whatever crazy project he likes, and the bond markets will never punish him because the bond vigilantes have been put out of business?
Well, here's the point, I think. I think it's right that it's likely that the real cost of government debt will remain very low and, in fact, negative. But just because you could borrow at, let's say, minus 2% real interest rates, if you then use the money to invest in projects that have a return that's even more negative than minus 2%, you're still in trouble. And I'm kind of pretty gloomy about the record, not of this government, but of governments in general, on very big spending projects. And HS2 is a wonderful example. It will have an internal rate of return that's massively negative, I would think. So even if you could borrow at minus 2, minus 3% real, you can still bankrupt yourself if you invest in a truly crappy project.
Well, David, I suspect Boris Johnson might be about to test that hypothesis. Thank you very much. Thanks also to Harriet and Paul, and thanks to Charles Stanley for sponsoring this podcast. Thank you for listening, and thanks to our producer, Cindy Yu.